Stars Over Surrey with Dave Gemmatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
Welcome, John.
Hello, Dave.
So we're going to talk about the world of spaceflight and astronomy, your constellation of the month, what to look for in the night sky next month, and events at local astronomy societies. But first of all, so what's going on then in spaceflight and astronomy at the moment, John?
Okay, Dave. Well, one thing that I mentioned last month was that the Chinese space station was expected down within a couple of days of the broadcast. And indeed, it came down, as most people thought, it was quite safe. It came down, broke up in the atmosphere somewhere over the South Pacific. And the shipping down that way is so sparse that nobody happened to notice it. At least we've not seen any pictures of the fiery re-entry, and nobody, as far as we know, has picked up any bits of it or anything like that, so relief that nobody was hurt. But in fact, many, many other objects larger than the Tiangong 1 have come down. I think that ranks number 49 in the top, in the biggest 50 of objects that have come down. But when things break up in the atmosphere, of course, it can cause quite a bang, quite an explosion. And there's one famous occasion when that happened, way back before spaceflight, but in 1908, an asteroid came into our atmosphere at great speed. And because of the heating and the shock waves it was experiencing as it came through the atmosphere, blew up somewhere over Siberia, a place called Tunguska, and that was June 1908. Massive explosion estimated at 3 to 5 megatons, something of that sort. Fortunately, again, an uninhabited part of Russia, and when they eventually mounted an expedition, which wasn't until about 2 decades later, all they found was I can't remember exactly how wide an area of devastation, but a huge swathe of forest still completely destroyed, laid flat, radiating out from the ground zero, the centre of the explosion in the air. Now, the reason I mention that is that we've only just missed another such event, and this was on the 15th of April. An asteroid about the same size that devastated the Tunguska forest passed by the Earth very close, about half the distance between the Earth and the Moon's orbit. And that wasn't seen until a few hours before it passed by.
You sure this isn't another UFO, John? I mean, coming that close to Earth, that's a sightseeing tour, I think.
Okay. Well, maybe they'll come back again and give us a wave next time. But this was a big beastie. They estimate somewhere between about 50 and 120 metres in size. And that is the largest ever known asteroid that's passed this close to Earth. So although we're getting a lot better at detecting these asteroids whose orbit can intersect that of Earth, it's still a little worrying that this one wasn't known about and was only discovered virtually on its way out. So let's keep our fingers crossed that our detection methods improve somewhat.
Aliens have stealth technology, you know, John.
Ah, why didn't I think of that now?
Romulans, definitely.
Are you sure it's not the Klingons? Okay. Now let's move on to something of quite local interest. But first of all, talk about SpaceX, as we do almost every month. They're doing so well.
We love SpaceX.
Absolutely, and Elon Musk too. But the SpaceX Dragon resupply capsule has been up to the International Space Station. It's one of those that has made a trip previously, has returned to Earth, parachuted safely down, been collected, refurbished, and this has made its second flight. And in keeping with their philosophy of reflying wherever possible their Falcon 9 booster, this one was launched on a previously flown Falcon 9. Now, that took up over 2,500 kilograms of cargo and experiments up to the International Space Station, where, of course, we've got a crew of six. Many of those will have been unpacked by the crew of the ISS, opening the hatch where the Dragon capsule has docked and retrieving the items from within. But some of them are packed in an external cargo bay, and they're recovered by a remote manipulator arm, which has been provided to the ISS by Canada. Now, amongst those experiments is something made locally, made by SSTL, Surrey Satellites and Technology Limited. Now, they're a spin-off from Surrey University, but the experiment was actually designed by the Surrey Science Centre at the Surrey University. Now, you know that there's an awful lot of space junk up in orbit. Defunct satellites, a few things that have collided with each other and shattered, spent upper stages of rockets, fairings from rockets, even down to things like tool bags, spanners that International Space Station astronauts have dropped while they're working outside. Now, those things can cause huge damage if they collide with another spacecraft, or even worse, a manned one, because of the speed at which they're travelling. So there have been quite a lot of research done in how can we reduce this, how can we bring things down. And the debris removal experiment, as I say, has been developed by Surrey University. So it's a satellite that has been built down at Guildford, and that has been taken up on that Falcon 9, retrieved by the crew, put into the space station for preparation, where it will be deployed, I think now, within a matter of probably just days from now. Now, that satellite itself, relatively small, but it's got a couple of internal satellites, CubeSats, which it will release once it has been deployed itself by the manipulator arm on the space station. One of those CubeSats is going to be captured by a net that's going to be fired from the satellite to test out whether that would work for larger objects. One of the other things it's going to be doing is going to be experimenting with how we an operator on Earth could track a satellite from manually or and visually from this retrieving satellite. So that's another experiment using one of these CubeSats, which will be a target. The main spacecraft itself has got a weapon on board. Not a space laser, lasers on stun or anything like that, David. Just a harpoon attached to a tether. It's going to deploy a target which it will fire at with the harpoon, just imagining that to be another satellite, and then it will reel it in. So that's an experiment to see, is that way of capturing satellites feasible? And then, of course, we don't want that satellite itself to become debris, another piece of space junk itself. So when its mission is finished, what it's going to do is it will deploy a sail, like a big umbrella. Now, although it's in space, there is still exceedingly tenuous but bits of atmosphere up there. You know, a few atoms, a few molecules, the upper edges of our atmosphere. Now, those will interact with the big sail, and gradually it will start to slow down as if it was in a wind. And as it slows, so its orbit will decay, it will drop, and so the atmosphere gets thicker, slows it down even more, and so eventually it will burn up. So that's part of the experiment to see whether how well it will bring down larger satellites if we could attach a sail to them and just deorbit them that way. So no doubt, as it's a local experiment, we'll try and keep an eye on that and see how well that experiment goes. Now, another SpaceX launch took tests, an exoplanet hunting satellite, and that was launched on Wednesday the 18th of April. And true to SpaceX's tradition, that Falcon 9 rocket flew back to the place from which it was launched and was landed vertically for refurbishment and later use. Now, tests, the scientists always do very, very well coming up with nice little mnemonics to name their satellites. TESS stands for Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. Now, we know of 8 planets in our solar system. We thought there was a 9th one, Pluto, but that was downgraded as too small, really. But over the last 20 years or so, we have now discovered towards 4,000 exoplanets orbiting around other stars. We believe that our sun is not unique, that every star is likely to have a planetary system around it. Difficulty is, of course, is detecting something so small, so far away. And the best way of finding them is to study the light of a target star and see whether that dips a little bit. And the reason for dip is because a planet which happens to be in line of sight orbiting that star will pass in front of it and therefore blot out a little bit of its light. So it's a tiny, tiny little dip, but the instruments are so sensitive that they can pick this up. And that's the main way of detecting solar exoplanets, outside our solar system. We've even done this for Guildford Astronomical Society, a known exoplanet. We knew what time it was going to pass over its star. And from our observatory, we measured the faint dip in that luminosity of that star. So this TESS mission is equipped with 4 massive cameras, 16.8 megapixel cameras, and it's got about a 2-year expected life, and it's thought that in that 2 years it could detect, hopefully, up to about 20,000 exoplanets. They're aiming it at, not just randomly, they're aiming it at stars that perhaps studies from Earth, or more likely from the Kepler space mission, which has been identifying exoplanets but is at the end of its life now, candidates for there being exoplanets there. So that will increase its chances of finding them. It's in a very extreme orbit. It's going to be highly elliptical. The very closest it's going to be to Earth, and it's in transit at the moment to this newer orbit, the closest it will be 67,000 miles, and that's at what we call perigee, closest to the Earth. And it's actually going to go out beyond the Moon's distance at apogee, the furthest point in its elliptical orbit. The Moon is 250,000 miles away, give or take. And it's in a particular relationship with the Moon's orbit, a 2-to-1 resonance. Now, that means the satellite's orbit will take 13.7 days, and as we know, the Moon takes 27 and a bit days to go round. So that resonance means that the gravitational effects of the Earth-Moon system will keep that spacecraft in a fairly stable orbit without the need to carry a lot of manoeuvring fuel on board, which of course means that the payload can be given over to experiments rather than taken up with fuel. It also keeps it away from the quite dangerous Van Allen radiation belts, which extend out 600, 1,000, a couple of thousand miles. That's well above where most of our satellites operate, but they can interfere with sensitive instruments, such as on the spacecraft. So it's far enough away to avoid the Van Allen radiation belts, but close enough at its closest point to downlink the mass of data that it will have captured in each orbit. So it'll download its data using a high-speed downlink once every 13 days or so. So that's going to be quite fascinating to see the number of exoplanets that we discover. Now, of course, that's only for the stars whose planets happen to be in line of sight with Earth. So from that, you can extrapolate how many more there will be that would never transit across their star as seen from Earth. So we are not alone, I'm sure.
When do they reckon TESS will start working?
Oh, I think it's going to take more than a month to settle down in this orbit. I know they're going to test the cameras in about 2 weeks' time. But I don't believe that the orbit will be in a state that they'll start the observations. I think they're going to study something like 27 degrees of the sky at a time in one orbit, then switch to another 27th swathe of the sky. Fascinating mission. We've had another fascinating mission, of course, at Jupiter. And I mentioned that last time, looking at what the NASA Juno mission had discovered about the belt surrounding Jupiter's either side of its equator. They've just released more data from the Juno mission, which is on its latest science orbit, has been studying the North Pole, not in visual light, but using its GIRAM instrument, Jovian Infrared Auroral Mapper. Now, that can see below the visual breakoff point, which is the top of the clouds. That can see between 30 to 45 miles below the cloud tops. And what it's discovered is that there's a central cyclone, which was already known, on the North Pole, but it's surrounded by eight further cyclones. And each of these four smaller cyclones, still pretty massive, about 2,500 miles in diameter. Interesting data that has now been returned. And that mission will be continuing for a year or more yet, returning more and more data about our biggest planet in our own solar system. Now, talking of big things in our solar system, some researchers have recently concluded that we had something even bigger than Jupiter pass through our solar system 70,000 years ago. In fact, another star. But not the size of our sun, a tiddly little one, the sort that we call a red dwarf, actually the most common type of star in the Milky Way. Red dwarfs are small things, probably 7 or 8% or thereabouts of the mass of the sun. One of these is called Schultz's star, and that's now about 20 light years away. But its orbit, its trajectory has been traced back together with where our sun has been as it moves around the Milky Way, and they intersect. So it's thought that Schultz's star passed within one light year of the solar system. Now, it's four light years to the nearest star, so you might think one light year is well outside our solar system, but not so. We now believe that the Oort cloud, which is this outer shell of material left over from the formation of the solar system, extends out to well beyond 1 year, one light year, possibly up to two light years away. Now, it's fairly sparse out there. The number of comets that make up the Oort cloud, and which is where many of the comets that visit the inner solar system will have come from, the number of them to have been affected is fairly small. The researchers have tracked back the orbits of about 300 or so objects that look as though they might at some stage leave our solar system. Remember, Dave, a few months ago we talked about Oumuamua, an object that visited our solar system, having been thrown out from some other solar system. Well, of course, our solar system sheds things as well. So they've traced back these the paths of these, the radiance of where these 300 suspect objects have come from, and they all tie in, or most of them tie in, with where that star would have passed through the Oort cloud. So that looks as though it's confirmed that theory. So, interesting. Let's move on, talking about the sun and visiting stars. And I talked about things moving around the solar system. Well, our star, the sun, when it formed, collapsed out of a under gravitation out of a cloud of gas. But that gas cloud initially would have been huge. It wouldn't have been just giving birth to our star. It would have been giving birth to dozens, hundreds, probably, of stars. And we see this, the effect of this, when we look into the night sky and we see what we call star clusters. Now, our star is likely one of many that all formed from the same huge gas cloud, but they're not here now. Over the millions and billions of years, the stars will have moved, been attracted by others, passing around the galaxy, and will have gone wandering. We'd like to know where those stars are. So scientists based at the Anglo-Australian Observatory in Siding Springs, I think that's New South Wales, they've collected data to help us to find these stars. Now, when you go looking for a long-lost relative, Dave, down here on Earth, the way we can do it is by DNA matching. Now, of course, stars don't have that sort of thing, but what they do have is a spectral type. And that is the idea of the light gives us an idea about their chemical constituents. And so we know exactly what type of star the sun is. So they've been hunting for stars of identical kind of spectral type using spectroscopy. So they hope that the data collected will reveal, you know, not just information about where our stars are, just so that we can wave at them, but that will give us an idea about what has happened in the early days of the galaxy and star formation and the movements of those stars around the galaxy. They also hope, I believe, to learn a little bit about dark matter as a result of that as well. And they've just released this information now to tie in with the release only a few days ago of information from Gaia. And I hope to talk more about that next month when I've had the chance to read up on it. Gaia is a European Space Agency mission which is out there mapping the nearest 10 to 20, eventually, billion stars. So it's just had a study done of the nearest 1.5 billion stars. I think it's billion. and they've released that data. So giving us a map of our local part of our Milky Way. Talking of galaxies, there's a galaxy that has been discovered a long time ago, 1875, by some British lord whose hobby was astronomy, and it's been given the title NGC for New Galactic Catalogue 1277. And it's a type of galaxy called a lenticular galaxy. No particular spiral structure, but just shaped like a lens. Now, that's not near, not really. It's 238 million light years away. But it's of interest because recent studies have shown it to be a relic of what is believed to have been the types of galaxy that existed in the early universe not that long after the Big Bang. These would have been incredibly active monster galaxies, much, much bigger than our Milky Way. And they would have been gas-rich, and they would have churned out new stars about 1,000 times more frequently than our Milky Way creates new stars as it does at the moment. So this galaxy is one of a type called Red and Dead. It's had arrested development. It's stopped. There's no gas left in it. It's just stars. And no blue stars, blue-white stars. Blue and white stars are energetic stars that live relatively short lives in astronomical terms. Red, like the red dwarf I mentioned to you earlier, stars live a long, long time. So that's all this galaxy is made up from, just stars, no gas at all. So that's now pointed out as being a relic of one of these incredibly active monster galaxies, you know, from shortly after the Big Bang. Now, there are others known about, but they're all extremely distant. And this one is relatively in our backyard. I say backyard, 238 million light years away, but that is close in terms of the size of the observable universe. And that galaxy lives in what's called the Perseus Galactic Cluster. So, interesting news, interesting developments. I'm talking of, I should have said, it's thought that that galaxy is probably 10 billion years old. Okay. Now, talking of distant things, our nearby Hubble Space Telescope has just spotted the most distant star that's ever been seen. Now, we can see individual stars in nearby galaxies like the M31, the Andromeda galaxy, but mostly it's just a fuzz, all the light of distant stars merging into one. The technique that Hubble has used is called gravitational lensing. Now, we know that light is bent by the effect of mass. And we have mass in something like the Sun, where this concept was first proved, but of course even more so in galaxies. So when you get a galaxy in direct line of sight behind another galaxy, or a cluster of galaxies, you'd think you can't see the distant galaxy because it's hidden. But the light is bent, it's refracted round the intervening galaxy or galaxy cluster. And so we've detected things that are immensely distant because of this effect of gravitational lensing. It magnifies usually about 50 times. So that technique has been used to study distant galaxies. Astronomers can reassemble the smeared image to what it started out like so they can study the original source of light. This is the first time, though, that when using this technique, astronomers spotted what they thought, well, perhaps it's a supernova, something shining very brightly. But it turned out not to be getting any hotter, not to getting any brighter, not fading away, to be constant. So they've realised it's just an ordinary star, and that this galaxy cluster that's done the lensing has magnified about 2,000 times, which is phenomenal. So this star, a blue supergiant star, so very, very bright, highly active, has been nicknamed Icarus, after the Greek mythological character who flew too close to the sun. And that star is about 9 billion light years away. So that's the first time anything like that has ever happened. I think that's mostly it, Dave, apart to say that on May the 5th, next week, we've got InSight that I've mentioned, a NASA probe being sent to Mars. InSight standing for Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy and Heat Transport. All of that pushed together to make InSight. So unlike the other Martian probes we've talked about, which are land, are rovers, this one will be stationary, because it's to study Mars's interior. So the seismometer it will deploy needs to be stationary, dead still, so that it can pick up Mars quakes. And interestingly, that will be the first seismometer deployed anywhere in the solar system, apart from Earth, but since one was left on the Moon by the Apollo astronauts. It will also deploy a thermal probe. It will drill about 5 meters down into the Martian crust and deploy this probe to study heat flow. So the idea is to try and find out how Mars formed. So there you are, Dave. Those are the things that have attracted my interest over the last month.
Thank you, John, for the update.
Stars Over Surrey, Constellation of the Month.
For this month, I've chosen Leo, which is very well placed in the night sky, in the south to southwest, you know, at about 10 o'clock. It's not that far from last month's constellation of the month, which was Cancer. It's one of the perhaps best known constellations, quite recognisable once you get used to the idea of trying to imagine a lion shape sitting down, perhaps a sphinx. It's got a sickle, which makes up the chest, the neck, and the head, a sickle shape. One very bright star in it called Regulus, Alpha Leonis, contains several galaxies of interest. So there'll be more of that on the clip that has been produced and will be up on the website.
Thank you, John.
Oh, let me...
The month ahead for Stars Over Surrey.
Okay, so the May night sky, Dave, some splendid objects coming up in the night sky of this month. So it's one of my favourite months, oddly, in that we've still got some of the winter objects just disappearing from sight at dusk, but still available if you're quick. And by the end of the evening, we're starting to get some of those wonderful summer objects, like Hercules and the M13, the globular cluster within. The constellation of Altair with the Ring Nebula within that. Both of those objects are always wow objects to show to people at star parties and so on. And for amateur astronomers who are keen on galaxy hunting, this is the time of year for galaxy hunting within Leo, within Coma, Berenices, and within Virgo. Masses of faint fuzzies for us amateurs to hunt. In terms of looking at the Moon, best time of that would be the 21st or thereabouts, a few days either side. For galaxy hunting, then the 15th. That's when New Moon is. The first quarter is on the 7th, and Full Moon is on the 29th. Planets, we're starting to get them back in the evening now. You've possibly seen a very, very bright spark in the west-northwest sky after sunset. That's Venus. Brilliant. Magnitude -3.8. And that's visible for up to about 3 hours after sunset. You just can't miss it. Go out, find a clear sky in that direction, and you'll see it. Mars is a morning object, but getting brighter now. Mars has now reached negative magnitude, starts the month at -0.4, brightening to -1.2 as the month draws on. Downside is it's fairly low in the southeast, and you do have to get up in the early hours to find it, but it will be getting earlier and earlier, becoming you know, something to watch from about midnight, and then eventually, as the year goes on, in the evening as well. And it will be a very good apparition, very close to us, relatively, and very bright later on in the year. Jupiter is nice and bright. That's now rising in the evening, best seen after midnight at the moment. And again, very bright, as I say, magnitude -2.5. So look south in the early hours, very bright object, that's Jupiter. And even a pair of binoculars will reveal it, not as a dot, as a small point of light, but as a disc. Easily visible disc. A small telescope should show you the bands around the either side of the equator and across the four Galilean moons. Saturn is around in the morning, not as bright as the other objects I've talked about. This is magnitude plus 0.7, but it is getting better, improving as the month progresses, but very low, I'm afraid, in the morning southern sky. Uranus, Neptune, Mercury, not visible at the moment. There aren't any meteor showers or comets or anything particularly startling to point out for May, but there are some nice conjunctions. That's when something like a couple of planets are close together, apparently, just line of sight in the evening sky, or the moon. And in this case, I think they pretty well all involve the moon. On the 5th, the moon and Saturn are just 3 degrees apart. So if you hold out your hand at arm's length and stick three fingers together, that's about the gap that 3 degrees would be. So it's that far, that close rather. So if you haven't seen Saturn before and not sure how to find it, on the 5th, go out, find the moon. Sure, everybody can find the moon, and put your hand up, judge this 3 degrees, and look for Saturn nearby. Similarly, same sort of distance, the moon will be 3 degrees from Mars before dawn the next morning on the 6th. Saturn will be visible very close to a well-known globular cluster called M22, number 22 on the Messier list, and that's in the constellation of Sagittarius. So get your binoculars, find Saturn, and 1.5 degrees below Saturn, you should see this fuzzy ball, and that is the globular cluster M22. On the 17th, the moon is about 5 or so, that's a fist at arm's length, below Venus, low in the west-northwest. So that would make a good picture, the crescent moon and the bright Venus. Try and get something like a building or a tree in the image to give context. That's the best advice for photography. Venus is near a star cluster, a Messier object. That's M35. And that's an open cluster, like the one I talked about. The Sun used to be a member of an open cluster at some point. And that M35 is in Gemini, just above the top toe of one of the twins. Back to 3 degrees or there again, and the Moon, Jupiter and the Moon, 3 degrees apart on the 27th at about 10 p.m. So again, quite a nice photograph if you can frame that nicely. Meetings at local societies, Thursday the 3rd of May at Guildford Astronomical Society, a society to which I belong. We've got Dr. Marcel Tessenyi from the Department of Physics and Astronomy at University College London. And he's talking about a relatively low-cost approach to space science missions called TWINKLE. So he'll be telling us all about TWINKLE. A few days later, at Farnham Astronomical Society, Tuesday the 8th of May, one of their members, Danny Thomas, who's a very good speaker, will be doing Inflation, the Beginning and End of the Universe. Question. So inflation was the process by which the universe expanded after the Big Bang. Little further afield, at Croydon, they meet at Royal Russell School, Coombe Lane, Croydon. Well, they've got two meetings per month, but the AGM is on the 11th of May, so really that's members only. But on the 25th of May, they've got chairman I know from Hampshire Astronomical Group, Graham Bryant, another excellent speaker, doing a talk called Sun, Sea and Smoke. Sounds interesting. I've no idea what it's addressing, but it's fascinating subjects, sun, sea and smoke. Yule Astronomical Society meet on the 11th of May, 7:45 at Nonsuch High School for Girls in Cheam. A lady from the Mid-Kent Astronomical Society, Caroline Beavis, I've not heard her speak, but her talk is on Space Dogs, the True Story of Russia's Canine Cosmonauts. And last thing to tell you about, the sky at night. That's back, and we have a galactic revolution. I mentioned, Dave, a little earlier, the Gaia mission. And Chris Lintott and Maggie Adarin-Pocock are learning about this release of data from the European Space Agency Gaia mission. So it's to tell us about what has been revealed so far about the formation and evolution of the Milky Way. So the first showing of that is on Sunday the 13th of May, BBC 4, as always, at 10 p.m. Same station on Thursday for the repeat, 17th of May, 7:30. So that's it, Dave. That's my what's up for May.
Thank you, John, for the fascinating insights. Now, this show will be repeated on Monday night at 11 p.m. and is available after transmission as a podcast.
Stars Over Surrey with Dave Jamatis and John Axtell from the Guildford Astronomical Society.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with The Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.